Hello, and welcome to today's meeting of the Commonwealth Club. I am Lynn Curtis, co-chair of the club's Art Forum. We welcome our listening audience, and we invite everyone to visit us online at www.commonwealthclub.org. I'm going to, right now, it is my pleasure to introduce our speaker, Charles Koppelman. Born and raised in California, Charles Koppelman has a varied career producing, writing, directing motion pictures, documentaries, and other visual media. He recently produced and wrote the libretto for Cubanacan, the first new Cuban opera in 50 years. It premiered at the 2015 Havana Biennale. Koppelman also produced the performance film of the opera, which is now available on DVD, and his documentary chronicling the creative process of making the opera, filmed over the course of 10 years, will soon go into post-production. He is currently completing Zero Day, a feature documentary about the victims and consequences of internet surveillance and the problem of encryption. He is wrapping up production of At the Minimum, a documentary about a group of fast food workers in Oakland, California, and their campaign for a higher minimum wage and a union. Koppelman wrote and directed Dumbarton Bridge, a full-length dramatic feature film about a multiracial family confronting issues of belonging and identity, which is available on Netflix. And he served as field producer, co-writer for a Bill Moyers special, The Circle of Recovery, about a group of black men recovering from drug and alcohol addiction and their self-help treatment program. It had two national PBS broadcasts. Now it is my pleasure to introduce Charles Koppelman. Do you want to hold this or just?
No.
Okay. We can turn the lights down more if you need.
No, it's good there, yeah. Well, thank you, Lynn, and thank you, everybody, for coming. I need to do a little housekeeping here and turn off the music, which you probably didn't realize, but you were listening to some of the opera. I snuck it in there. Can you hear me? I'm sorry. How's that? That's much better. All right. I also want to thank Jeff and Jody Morgan, who supplied the wine from Covenant Winery, which is available now and until we run out. So Fidel Castro did not show up for rehearsal. I'll explain that in a minute. But first, you probably want to know who these two guys are, which you'll find out also. The gentleman on the left is Eli Gua, and he is a Cuban Santeria deity. He controls your fate and the roads. And on your right is Ricardo Porro, the architect who is the main character of the opera. This is a moment for me. Yeah, I love it. So we have two images. How is that possible? Maybe it got burned in. We'll see what happens next. How I produced the first new opera in 50 years and survived. I'll get to that in a second, too. But let's bring it up to the present. It was quite a week in Havana last week, obviously, with President Obama and the Rolling Stones. But it's not over until this week when the fat lady sings, and that's what we're going to do. Let me ask, how many have been to Cuba? Okay. And how many are planning to go? Okay, great. How many, there's a Commonwealth Club trip in a couple of days. How many of you are on that? Couple, okay. All right, great. So Fidel did not show up for rehearsal. Nope, not that one, El Comandante. He's 88 now, 89 actually, ailing and in seclusion. But this would be, in this opera, the first time he's ever been portrayed on stage. which I didn't really know about till a couple of weeks before. Regardless, on the first day of movement rehearsals, and here's some of the cast, on their very first day, he'd gone AWOL. Seriously, there is a character in the opera, Fidel, and the guy didn't show up. Okay, there's going to be some black slides. Don't panic. It's just my way of kind of creating some space, and so I can address you without having to support with pictures all the time. So producing the first new opera in Cuba since the revolution was audacious, and for an American to do this with an all-Cuban team and no support from either the U.S. or Cuban governments was pretty crazy, actually. I traveled to Havana on and off for 5 years to create this opera, but I conceived the project 13 years earlier with some confessions. I had no prior interest in Cuba. I'll say it like Mick Jagger. Apparently he said Cuba, which people just loved. So I'm going to say Cuba because I want to be like Mick Jagger. I had no prior interest in Cuba. I was not an opera buff. But it was the story because I'm a storyteller. And this is how the story begins. It's 1961. It's the Havana Country Club, which up until then was a playground of the rich and powerful, but abandoned after the revolution. This photo was taken by Corda, who was the house photographer for Fidel and Che in the revolution. Took some amazing pictures. The one you know of Che with his beret, that's a Corda picture. So as a lark, Fidel and Che played a round of golf, seriously. And it was on that day in 1961 when Fidel decided to build art schools on the fairways of that lush, beautiful country club. And he had to commission an architect. As the story goes, he was in his limo in downtown Havana when he spied Selma Diaz, who was a friend of his. Her husband was quite high in the revolution, and the limo was stopped, and he asked Selma if she knew an architect, because she was in development and housing and so forth. And she said, I have a friend, Ricardo Porro. He's the main character of this opera. He grew up middle class in Havana, left Cuba to study architecture in France, and then came home before the revolution. Soon he was hosting meetings in support of Fidel and the revolution in his apartment until it became too dangerous and he was advised to leave the country because Batista was cracking down. So he went to Venezuela. And while he was in Venezuela, the revolution happened. So he comes back to Havana. Now I'm giving you all this so you can appreciate the opera. Selma tells him, I have a commission from Fidel if you're interested. And it was to build those art schools on that golf course. And for Porro, it was a commission of a lifetime. Of course, Fidel wanted it done in 6 months, which was impossible. But he took it anyway, and he brought in two friends, two Italian architects. On the left, yes, on the left is Roberto Gottardi, and on the right, Vittorio Garatti. And together, the three of them designed and built these five schools. They are very postmodern, tropical, sensuous schools, and they're now on the World Heritage Fund list of endangered historic sites. This is the School of Plastic Arts, meaning painting, sculpture, drawing, so forth. And the image quality, unfortunately, is not so great on this screen, but I think you can see that there's a lot of Afro-Cubanism in the design. There's also a lot of eroticism in the design, but we'll get to that. This is the School of Ballet, never used. Alicia Alonso, who was still alive and was head of the ballet in Cuba, came out there one day, and there's always in Cuba many stories. One story was she looked at that main stage on the bottom, which was a circular stage, and she said, I can't do ballet in this space. I need a stage, a theater. And there on the upper left, you can see the aerial of what that looks like. This was designed by Garatti. Another story says that she could feel the winds blowing, which were beginning to turn against the schools, and she was very political. And maybe it wasn't such a good idea to be associated. This is the School of Music, otherwise known as the Worm, because it's very long and undulating. It's not in very good shape, as you can see in the lower right, but it's still used occasionally. The Drama School, on the left, you can see it. This was shot while it was soon after they stopped working on it, I believe. And on the right, you can see it's actually a present-day photo. This was designed by Gottardi. He called it the medieval city. And it has this quality, very narrow passageways. You can't really see where your next step is going to go. It's very claustrophobic. It's kind of cool. The sad thing about the School of Drama is there's no theater. They never got to it. So it's part of the sort of tragedy of this story, in a way. The School of Modern Dance, designed by Porro. The upper left is the aerial. He called it the fist through glass, was his metaphor. And for that, he meant the revolution was like a fist through glass, and it shatters. And so he designed it with that in mind. And then the lower right is a rehearsal, still used. That one is in fairly good shape. The two, School of Plastic Arts, School of Modern Dance, are in the best condition. That is in the School of Modern Dance, young guy playing conga. There are various explanations for why the schools were never finished and for years left to decay in the tropical humidity. Some say it's a matter of priorities. At that moment, 1963-4, education, infrastructure, agriculture took precedence over the arts, and that so funding was diverted. Another theory says that the bureaucrats in the Ministry of Construction were envious of Porro and his partners, and they didn't want these guys to have the success, and that they maneuvered to kill the project. Here's another set of images of the School of Plastic Arts. You'll see these archways in a moment, again, used in a different way. The cupolas under them are studios. They're divided up into like open quadrants, and students work in there. And this is the famous, to those who know it, the papaya fountain, which they had that turned off. It used to spout water. If those of you are familiar with Cuban culture, the papaya is female genitalia. And for Porro to put this fountain in there was a huge statement, okay? And it still gets giggles in Cuba. Despite never being finished in their fullness, like I said, ballet school never used. The circus actually did rehearsals in there for a while, but was never used for ballet. And the music school being incomplete, things deteriorated quite badly in the 80s and 90s. But they've been used continuously, regardless of their condition, since they opened. And what you see here is, you know, present day. On the upper left is the clubhouse, the old clubhouse that was converted into now sort of a rehearsal space, meeting rooms, offices, and so forth. It's beautiful, marble, and it's a pleasure to see the students coming in and out. That's the School of Plastic Arts in the lower right. And in the back, you wouldn't know it, but there's a pool left over from the golf course. And on Saturdays, the students are allowed to use the pool, and they have a really good time in there. Some of Cuba's finest artists and performers have studied, and I couldn't possibly list them all. There's hundreds. But a few, Gonzalo Rubalcaba at the top, jazz pianist who now lives in the U.S. Lower left, the artist Tanya Bugera. And the lower right is a creation of Los Carpinteros, which is a trio of guys who are quite wonderful and creative. The schools have produced an amazing amount of talent. Okay. Well, there's the end of the opera. Wow. So the opera opened the 2015 Havana Biennale, and I was lucky and fortunate, blessed to work with 30 Cuban performers, 54 musicians, a sizable production crew, and spending a chunk of money. I learned a lot about Cuba, and I learned a lot about myself. But how did we get here? This is John Loomis and a story about the schools that was in the San Francisco Chronicle in 2002 that caught my eye, and that's how it started. The article led me to an exhibit with photographs, blueprints, and this tale, which just took hold of me and wouldn't let go. Now, I'm a filmmaker mostly, and I struggled to think of a film that could tell this story. Documentary, dramatic film. It just never clicked for me. I was reading this book by John Loomis, now in its second edition, which is a chronicle of that story. And the more I read, you know, the more I knew I had to do something. All right, Francis Ford Coppola. Now, what's he doing in this story? I'm not making a film. Well, I think the fourth time I read that book, and I'm underlining over and over again the same passages, I remember that he once said, maybe true or not, but he's quoted as saying that opera was the precursor to movies. Sight, sound, montage, that was popular entertainment in the 19th century. Of course, his father was a famous opera orchestra conductor. And so I thought, well, that could be it. This wants to be an opera. There's another picture of Ricardo Porro. I think that was about 5 years ago in front of his school. So each of these schools is dedicated to, as we've talked, a different art form, ballet, modern dance, drama, music, and fine arts. And these are all the building blocks of opera. So I realized the narrative had larger-than-life figures, Fidel, Che. This has got to be an opera. And then when I met Porro, which wasn't too much later, he passed away 2 years ago, totally operatic character. And it all produced for me the elements of a classic opera. I just have to figure out how to do it, because I've never done one. So after several years and one whole creative team later, I took a trip. Yep, that's Miami, to Cuba. Because I'd done all this without being there. I know it's kind of wacky, but that's where I was. And I went with a group of friends and opera supporters. And while I was there, I found a Cuban composer, Roberto Valera. I was introduced to him by a mutual friend. I wasn't really there officially to start the opera. I just wanted to get to meet some people. And I liked his power and his questions. He asked me, is this for Broadway or is this for the Met? It's like, good question. And then he asked, do you hear Verdi or Stockhausen? It's like, another good question. He had composed for orchestra, chamber, chorale, films, even cartoons, because in Cuba you have to kind of do a little everything. But he had never done an opera. And here this guy shows up. He taught, still teaches, at those schools, ISA, now it's called, the Instituto Superior des Artes. He teaches composition there. So this story was close to him. He was there when it started. And after listening to maybe a dozen other possible composers inside and outside Cuba, I selected Valera. I wrote the libretto, he did the music. And we worked for several years, just the two of us, not knowing where it would go, if it would get done, just one foot after the next. And then 3 years later, so now we're up to 2014, this guy in the upper left, Jorge Fernandez, who I'd gotten to know, used to be a dean at the art schools, gave my wife and I our first tour of the art schools. we're having a beer. I should explain. The upper right is the Wilfredo Lam Contemporary Arts Center, which he's the director of. He actually just left. He got promoted to another museum. Isn't that a beautiful thing? It's an amazing old villa from the 19th century. The galleries are upstairs. Any case, right next door was a cafe. And he said, let's go have a beer. And he said, so the opera's going to be done in a year, do you think? And, of course, I had no idea because it was only half done. But I said, yes, because you're a producer, you have to say yes. I said, yeah, no problem. And in 30 seconds, it happened. Good things happen quickly. He said, all right, I want to put it on at the Biennale next year, which was a year away. I was like, okay. And they have a beautiful teatro in central Havana. That's where Obama gave his speech. It's been completely rehabbed. It's beautiful. The Lorca Theater. And, of course, I thought of that because I've been in there. And I said, the Lorca, right? And he went, no, no, no. He said, the art schools, we do them out there. I go, whew, all right, let's do that. So the Biennale, and that's their, that was the logo, 2015. I should explain, in Havana, it's not really a Biennale, it's a Triennale. They can really only get it together every 3 years. They call it the Biennale, but it's really every 3 years. And they're not embarrassed by that. It's just hard to get stuff done there. So at that point, I had to find some money, as usual, finish writing the libretto, have Valera, and he goes by his last name. Most of the men in Cuba are called by their last name. I don't know if it's left over from, you know, Comrade Valera and Comrade Fernandez, but anyway, that's how they do it. He had to finish the music, had to raise some money for production. And interesting, I didn't know at the time, but the theme of the Biennale for that year, for last year, was Entre la idea y la experiencia. My Spanish is terrible. Between the idea and the experience, which actually is perfect for what I was trying to do, because here was the idea of the opera, and then here was the experience of actually doing it. And, well, you'll hear some stories. Okay, so now I have to find a director, a stage director. And I approached and was introduced to three Cuban stage directors. And it took a long time, but they all just never answered after meeting and saying, oh, I'm interested, or yes, but maybe let me get back to you. It was kind of like Hollywood. They just don't like to say no. And I kept waiting. And it got to the point where I couldn't really wait anymore. So I found this gentleman, Charles Chamin, on the right, French-American, lives in Paris. That's Valera on the left. And he was the stage director, came in very last minute, 6 weeks before we started. And it happened at this place. I just couldn't resist putting it up. This is an alley in Havana, around the corner from the Piazza Catedral. At the end of the alley is the Telegrafico, which is a print collective. It's beautiful. And there's several restaurants here. And it's an amazing little, like, 200 yards or less. And here we had, at This Is Not a Cafe, the come to Fidel meeting about the director. Because the head of the Biennale is saying, okay, it's March, and you open in 10 weeks. Where's the director? Where's the infrastructure? Because I was waiting and raising money. So it was pretty surreal. I'm glad we ate at the Duchampian restaurant. And I said, look, I've tried Cuban directors. I felt like this should be a Cuban director. I have a possibility for a French-American director, but I don't want to offend anybody. And he says, we love to work with outsiders. The performers will love exposure to someone from outside. What are you waiting for? You know, basically slapping me. So the next day, I wrote Chamin and said, come on, let's do this. And there he is, again, with his back to you. First day of movement rehearsal. So let's get to what happened to Fidel. I kind of dropped that. So around this time, a soprano approached me and Chemin, the director, and said, the tenor playing Fidel is out. No one told us. The soprano told us. And she grinned, was like, wow, this is strange. Turns out he'd been fired or quit or took another job. She wasn't sure. So this facility, this is called the Teatro Lirico in downtown Havana, where there's an opera company and it's like a graduate school of music. The head of it had done the casting for me and made the arrangements. And we ran downstairs to see Mr. Chorenz, Senior Chorenz. Where's Fidel, right? He says, well, you know, he doesn't read music. Okay. And he learns by ear. It's like, okay. And anyway, he took another job. And, you know, it's hard to explain, but when you're at this point, we were like 6-7 weeks out, and you don't have the full cast, and you have a principal who's playing Fidel, who's never been portrayed on stage before. There isn't a Fidel. Your heart does start beating. Well, anyway, he took another job here, it turned out. This is the Pina Colada Festival. I'm serious. On the other side of the island. And so Senor Chorin says, kind of like no big deal, he says, I'm sure it pays better. And it'll be more comfortable for him. It's like, okay, great. And anyway, don't worry. I heard that a lot. Don't worry. So let me just back up a step. Now, you have to understand, for those of you who've been to Cuba, you know, but basics like food, transportation, and housing are real hurdles in Cuba. And you can see habaneros walking proudly down the street, nicely dressed, heads held high. But you wouldn't know that at home their water may not be running and may have been off for 3 days. They spent 2 hours in two buses getting to work, and they only live 5 miles away. And their ration book for food staples was used up already, and they're kind of running out of supplies. Okay. Black slide. So revolutions are not easy, okay, and they are rarely successful. And this is actually a subtext for the opera. How a romantic, idealistic moment, signified by Fidel's decision in 1961 to build these art schools on a golf course, was eclipsed by ideology, political conflict, economic missteps, perhaps. It's complicated, as they say in Cuba. In any case, at last a new Fidel showed up. This is Roger, a professor of music and opera at the art schools. He was a little behind, needed some time to learn his part, but he was game, and he's letting his beard grow out, as you can see here. I think this was his second or third day. So we began building the stage, which is right there at the front of the School of Plastic Arts, upper left. The stage was very wide and narrow to fit the vaulted archways, which became part of the set, became the set. And to utilize this area was a big challenge for Chemin, the director, because it's a big space. So the chorus was on the stage a lot, even when they weren't singing, which was very unusual for Cuba. They are trained very traditionally. But once the chorus, I was 20, realized they were going to be in the show a lot, even if they weren't singing, they're going to be moving and dancing, they were thrilled. They loved it. So it's kind of what Jorge Fernandez told me at the beginning. They will love working with someone who brings new ideas. Okay, so then it became time for the cast to try on their costumes. Here's Eligua again. He was beaming, as you can see. And the costume fittings triggered, again, I'm kind of new to live theater, but it was a magical transformation. As soon as they put on their costumes and they were fitting, they became one with their character. It was a thrill. And the opera was morphing from notes and words to something real tangible and emotional. And a word about the costumes. This is Robin Chemin, Yes, related. Charles's mom. She did all the costumes and sewed many of them herself. We had some help. Very well-regarded wardrobe designer for opera, theater, and movies in Europe. She's based in Paris. And it was another last-minute solution because we had two or three costume designers flirt with us and then disappear. And at the last minute, he called in a big favor. Mom. And she was a real trooper because she didn't have anything near the budget she would have normally in Europe or the US. And it was quite challenging working with the local seamstresses and getting the materials. And oh my goodness. The sets were designed and built in Havana in 4 weeks, which was pretty rapid. And on this day, one of our main items, it's a reproduction of Jungla, the jungle, by Wilfredo Lam, who's a brilliant Cuban painter, lived in Europe. Porro met him. Porro was quite inspired by Lam. And this is the day it was delivered to the set. A couple days late, but beautiful. The original is at the MoMA in New York, by the way. It was a joyful moment and gorgeous. It's still down there, I hope, rolled up somewhere in a warehouse. Very joyful moment. But then, just to give you an insight, an hour later, the lighting director quits because he didn't agree with the lighting plan Chemin wanted, which was very chiaroscuro, very dark and light and dramatic, and it just wasn't something he did or wanted to do. So that was a moment. He literally got in his car and drove off. But my local producer, Maito, came back the next day and said, he's refreshed himself. He will return tonight. He wasn't very pleasant, but he was there. And we got what we needed. So, it's opening night. Valera and Chemin and I are at the front of the stage, and, you know, how do you start an opera? Again, I'm new to this, maybe they do this all the time. So, Valera says, merde. Chemin says, merde, which, you know, shit, which is their way of saying, you know, break a leg. So I said, merde, okay. And with that, Valera walked across the stage to his conducting position, and it was out of my hands at that point. The lights went down, and all the anxiety and the frustration and the fighting, and there was some fighting, not physical, arguing, was just prologue, the overture. And the Cubans were partly right. I did have to worry, because that's my job, but it was fine. So now I'm going to show you five-minute excerpt, I hope. There it is.
Thank you.
thank you. I guess we've got to get the lights back on. Let's see if I can remember how to do this. Yeah, what are those guys doing? Whoops. Too much. There we go. I know that's kind of abrupt, huh? All right. So, so there you had 5 minutes of an 82-minute opera. All right, now what do these guys have to do with it? So you have Scott Rudin in the upper left, Harvey Weinstein in the upper right, and Ricky Ricardo. I learned how to be a different kind of producer, getting this up and running and done. And these are kind of my hall of heroes. I began acting Cuban. I was there, just so you know, on and off for 5 years. The last trip was the entire month of May, getting ready for that. So in the process, I ended up becoming more brash, demonstrative, quick to anger, just like Ricky, caricature of a Cuban. But it also helped me to channel Harvey and Scott Rudin, Harvey Weinstein and Scott Rudin, two notoriously difficult movie and theater producers who get things done by knowing when and how to be extreme, and also when how to be gracious. So if a situation demanded, I could be charming, and I could connect emotionally, which is really important in Cuba. You have to, stand close to the person you're talking to, look directly in their eyes, grab the arm, and inquire about the family before you talk business. That's just the way it's done. And the California producing style, which is a little more laid back, at least up here, not in LA, was not going to cut it. So I became operatic in my own sort of method producing. So what about Cuba? And then we'll have some question and answer if you have any questions. So change is happening, of course, but I have just a couple of closing observations. It won't be this. And I don't think it's really going to be this. What's going to change Cuba fast and furious, in my opinion, is this. And it's starting. And it's not a bad thing, and it's not a good thing. It's just the thing that's going to happen there. And Google announced during Obama's speech that they've been approved to do home-based internet connections, which, if you have a connection to the government, you are given a home system, but it's only email. There's no web connection. To get online, you have to go to a hotel and spend, used to be 10, now it's $5 an hour, and it's not working most of the time, some of the time. There are now Wi-Fi hotspots in certain parts of the city, and you'll see pictures of young people congregated around, like the fireplace, but it's a hot spot, but you still have to pay. Anyway, that's all going to change. And no one really knows, but my feeling is it's the access to the outside world. It's the access to ideas and people that will have the biggest, quickest effect on that country. So that's it for me. If you have some questions, I'd be happy to take them. How do I get out of this? Let's see. I'll just close it.
Thank you so much, Charles. We're going to have a question and answer period, but I just want to remind our listening audience, you're listening to a program of the Commonwealth Club of California. You're listening to Fidel Didn't Show Up for Rehearsal with writer, producer, and director Charles Koppelman. I'm going to hand this around to those who raise your hand, and please speak into the mic closely so that we'll get you recording. Okay? So, who has a question? All right. Start here and I'll move back.
What was the basis for your going, given that the people-to-people program was in effect then, a few weeks ago? How did you get in and out and in and out of Cuba?
Right. So when I started traveling there, it was legal either as a people-to-people group tour, which actually was the first trip my wife and I did was on one of those. Subsequently, I went on my own under a license. There's 15 listed approved reasons to travel to Cuba. One of them, well, I actually qualified for two. At the beginning, it was just for professional research. And then once the Biennale invited us, it was to create a performance, which is another one of the, or to do a performance is one of the other approved items. You just have to kind of carry documentation. And, you know, we were checked a couple times coming home, but nothing really serious. It was pretty easy.
So I have a few questions about language. You said you're not very good at Spanish, but you wrote the libretto. So I'm curious as to who translated that. And then, and also, did that present problems for you and the director, who, I don't know that the director was a native Spanish speaker.
Right, language. So I wrote the libretto in English. It was translated by Cuban here to deliver to the composer, because he has to get it first to do the music. And in the process of writing the opera, he sets the text to the music. He has to, even if it was in his, the language was the same, he would still have to adapt and edit the words to fit the music, which is just comes with the territory. That's how it's done. In his case, he also retranslated some of it to find better words to say what we wanted to say that were more poetic or actually more authentic in Cuba. So it went through those two translations, basically. And then in terms of communicating a lot of the young people spoke English. I had a translator working with me from the beginning. For important meetings, I would have to. And then when we got into production, we had a second translator on the set provided by the schools. So I like to think that the language was never a barrier, but you know what? Culturally and so forth, I'm sure it was in some cases, but it wasn't overwhelming.
What is the future of the opera? Will we have the opportunity to see it?
Good question. I am working actively to bring it to the U.S. and to Europe. This was sort of a launch, and because it was site-specific, it'll never be like that again, which was a beauty, and also it's sort of, however, it needs to be adapted for a traditional theater. So I've been, over the years, in conversation with a number of opera companies just to get it on their radar, and there's a lot of interest from certain companies. Florida Grand Opera in Miami, BAM in New York, although they're not an opera company, they're a presenter. Lincoln Center Festival in New York. Los Angeles Philharmonic, which does semi-staged opera. So there's, you know, some circle of interest. No one's quite ready to jump in. The San Francisco Opera, one of my primary supporters is on the board, and he's been very helpful in introducing it to David Gockley, who's now retiring. They know about it. We'll see. I mean, the next step, actually, there's an intermediate step to make some revisions to this. In film, we call it, you know, it was a rough cut. It was good, but it's not quite finished. That's mostly me and the director. There's scenes that need to be adjusted, trimmed. A couple scenes need to be added. To do that, we're trying to have a workshop or two, and we've been invited to University of New Mexico, which has a very fine art and opera program. We're talking to the University of Southern California about that as well, and University of Washington. A university would be a great setting to work with their students, maybe bring in some Cubans, a kind of a cultural exchange. So that's the next logical step, hopefully in the next year, is to have these revisions made, and then it'll be more prepared and ready for someone to commit.
Hello. This being your first libretto, what was your process?
Process of writing a libretto. I have a really good friend that I wrote a screenplay with, and he wrote a couple of librettos, and I asked him. He said, man, it's really easy. It's just like, it's only like 20 pages, you know? So, you know, a writer always thinks that how long does it have to be, right? I had to learn some new chops for that, basically, and get my head into, you know, a kind of emotional, lyrical space that I don't normally write in. But once I was in there, you know, it flowed okay. And I knew it was overwritten. You kind of have to give the composer more. And then he can cut and choose and paste and move around. The hardest part I had writing was Fidel. And in early versions of this opera, he was a very, very minor character. And I had some table readings, and people said, we need more Fidel. We want more Fidel. I was like, okay, all right. And that was pretty intimidating for me to sit down at this laptop and write, put words in this guy's mouth, right? That took a couple of months of ramping up. And I found by reading his speeches, and there's thousands, and listening to him and reading some biographies put me in the space where I could sort of get into his head. And I actually lifted some words from his speeches because it's Cuba also, and I knew that I was on thin ice, you know, and I had to be not censorship, but careful and aware and sensitive. And I thought, well, by borrowing some of his speeches, that's going to be a little bit of protection, and also worked into the story. It wasn't like irrelevant. It was what he was saying at the time. So that's the libretto story.
Question, how did you patch together the financing? I'd be interested to hear the story of that.
No, the financing. The money was a combination of individual donations, foundation grants. There was no, like I said earlier, no government money from this side or that side. And near the end, and I have to say the individual donations pretty much outweighed the foundation grants in terms of just actual dollars. And then about 5 weeks before we opened, and I was maybe half short of the production money, typical, but frightening. My lawyer on this project, whose specialty is Cuban law, Cuban-American law, it was great, called me one day and said, well, I have a client who may be interested, because he knew I needed money. I said, well, who is he? He said, I can't tell you. He's kind of a spy guy. He loves, yeah, I met him in the airport in Havana, in the terminal for charter flights when our flight was 8 hours late. And so I bought a bottle of rum, and we split the bottle of rum and got to know each other, and he became my attorney. True story. He said, I can't tell you because I just can't tell you. I said, well, give me a hint. He goes, well, it's a tech company. I go, okay. Can you tell me more? Well, it's a tech company in the Bay Area. I go, oh, that's great. Now we're down to like 1,300 companies. And I love the guy. I mean, he's really great. So I don't mind playing that. I said, come on, just give me, all right. You know, in Cuba, they have Casa Particulares, which those of you who've been there know, where people rent out an apartment or their whole house. And they've been doing it for 15, 20 years. It's all legal and it's taxed. It's really very reasonable, a great way to stay when you're there and don't need a hotel. So he said, well, they're in the Casa Particular space. I go, okay, tech company. Sarah. I said, it's Airbnb. He goes, I can't tell you. But it was Airbnb. And they were planning to open, which they did, while I was there in April. And in two meetings, they came through with some underwriting money, which was huge and very timely.
I have it right here. So was this the first time Fidel was represented on stage? And if so, what was the public's reaction?
Right. I was told it's the first time. And I believe the sources were local, so I think it's true. And the first night, we did three shows. And the first night was mostly I was 65% Cuban audience, a lot of relatives of the players and the performers. And when he came out on the first time with his golf club, I could feel it, even though we were outdoors. There was like a whoo. The audience was like, whoo. You'd have to like really be paying attention, but I felt it. Just that moment, okay? Now, we didn't have any pushback. Now, you have to understand the Biennale is run by the Ministry of Culture. It's a government thing, right? And on the last night, the third night, the Vice Minister of Culture came, and I was told he was going to be there. And that's kind of a big deal. And to sort of answer your question, in a Cuban way, which is like that way, he came up to Valera and me afterwards, and first he spoke for about 20 minutes, which is what they do, because he needed to tell us, this was a fine show, and I know this story very well, and he kind of tells me, repeats back the whole history, which we had just done. Charming, but, you know, that's their way. And so at the end, he points to the stage, and he said, "You solved many problems." And on that, he turned and left. So I turned to my fixer, my translator, and I said, because he was with me through thick and thin, you know. I said, what does that mean? He goes, "I don't know." And it could have meant we solved a lot of production problems, which we did, just getting that theater and the lights and the power didn't go out. It could have meant politically we walked this line. I don't know what it meant, but I think it meant you put him up there and you put our story up there and you didn't blow it. And we respect it. So, nice. Go figure.
Charles, in that light, you know, I don't speak Spanish. I have no connection to Cuba. And yet, as I was watching the five-minute clip that you showed us, I found that the music and the way the singers performed it along, and it was helpful to have the subtitles in English so I could understand, I found it very moving. And I found it really connected me to their story, the story of Cuba and their struggle and their revolution. And I was wondering if the cast offstage was affected in a similar way to what they portrayed on the stage.
You mean in the process of
In other words, in the process of learning the rehearsals and whatever, right. did they realize just how tremendously moving the portrayal of this story was and how it told their story, their national as well as perhaps their personal story?
I think it did. I think I saw it in them from meeting them like that first day in that movement rehearsal to the very, very end. Yeah, a big connection, certainly to me and the director, who are the outsiders, you know, and it's really about the work. I mean, they're connecting to us because of the work. The story, they already know, a lot of them went to the school or go to the school. Half of the performers in the orchestra go to that school. They are so well educated. They know all the details. That's, you can just believe that. I think expressing it that way, yeah, in a format like that that's very emotional. They're very emotional people. I think it soared because of that, for sure. And the thing I told them early on was I, in taking it out of Cuba, want to bring them along. The world needs to see their talent. And it's amazing. It's amazing. I mean, they're brilliant and they're so well trained. So I kind of made an oath, you know. I said, I can't control it, but if I have any way to bring you guys along for the ride when we present this in other places. So that to me is my sort of giving back, because they gave a lot.
I'm afraid we have to come to an end here. We're running out of time, but perhaps, Charles, you can ask, you know, talk to the audience a little bit on your own after we formally end. So anyway, I'd like to thank Charles today for a wonderful talk. And now, the meeting in the Commonwealth Club of California, where you are in the know, is adjourned.